Good morning. This is the time and place for oral argument in the case State of Idaho versus Mario Reyes, docket number 46439. Here on behalf of the appellant is Andrea Reynolds. Here on behalf of the state is Mr. Wake. Everyone is here. Ms. Reynolds, are you prepared to go forward?
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead, please.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. Mr. Reyes was involved in a fight with his wife after they had both been drinking. His trial was riddled with evidentiary errors, and the prosecutors did everything they could and some things they couldn't in order to obtain a conviction. Not surprisingly, considering all of the evidence, the jury found Mr. Reyes guilty of the charged crimes. The state concedes on appeal that the district court made two errors. First, in allowing the jury to learn of prior criminal charges brought against Mr. Reyes relating to an earlier fight with his wife. And second, in allowing the jury to learn Mr. Reyes was on felony probation at the time of this fight. These were not the only errors that occurred at trial. I will focus my argument today on two additional errors that resulted in the admission of incredibly damaging evidence against Mr. Reyes. The two conceded errors, as well as all of the additional errors, were not harmless. That is, the state cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the evidence the jury heard, which should have been excluded, was unimportant in relation to everything the jury considered. This court should vacate Mr. Reyes' conviction. So let's look at the first error. The district court allowed the prosecutor to question Mr. Reyes regarding a police report of an earlier fight between Mr. Reyes and his wife. This was error under IRE 404B. So what happened is Mr. Reyes testified on direct that he went into his bedroom and locked the door before lying down. When asked why he locked the door, he said, quote, "When I argue with my wife, I usually close the door." The district court then permitted the prosecutor to question Mr. Reyes on cross-examination about an instance when he argued with his wife and did not close the door. That was from a 2015 police report. Now, the district court instructed the prosecutor not to refer to the actual criminal charges, which the district court did, and that is the conceded error, but the error was broader than that. The jury should not have heard anything regarding that earlier fight. It simply wasn't relevant to impeachment, which is what the state argued below and was what is argued on appeal. The fact that Mr. Reyes had previously argued with his wife and not locked the door behind him does not impeach his statement that when he argues with his wife, he usually locks the door. Just as much if I usually have a sandwich for lunch and I one day have soup, you can't impeach my statement that I have a sandwich by saying, look, Andrea, one day you had soup.
Reynolds?
Yes.
Is that the argument that was made in the trial court?
By the state or by defense counsel?
By defense counsel.
Yes. Yes, the original ruling was related to impeachment. That's correct.
No, did Mr. Reyes argue that the state was incorrect because he didn't say he always did something? He said he only usually did something?
That's my understanding of the record.
Do you have a cite to the transcript for that?
Not in front of me. I can find it and give it to you on rebuttal, but I don't have the transcript right in front of me today. The reason that the prosecutor wanted this evidence admitted was purely for propensity. And certainly the propensity argument is strong. The argument being if Mr. Reyes beat his wife once, he probably did it again. This is compelling for the jury. The jury wants, you know, is not concerned about the rules of evidence. The jury wants to know, is this guy a good guy, a bad guy? Did he do it? Did he not do it? That's sort of what the jury is essentially concerned with. Propensity evidence is very compelling for a jury to make that conclusion. That's why Rule 404B is so strong about only permitting propensity evidence in certain circumstances. Typically, propensity evidence is kept out. So what matters is what happened in the case that's being tried, the case that the state is presenting the evidence on at that time, not what happened or may have happened before. So that was the first mistake that the district court made in addition to the two conceded errors that I think resulted in very damaging evidence against Mr. Reyes. The second was, yes.
Did I just understand your argument correctly that the jury is deciding whether somebody's a good guy or a bad guy and not whether the defendant committed the crime alleged?
I'm sorry if I said it in such a way. I didn't mean to say that the jury is not following its instructions and interpreting the questions presented to it. I think the reason that propensity evidence is limited under 404B is because it's so damaging in the jury making its consideration and considering the instructions that are given. I think propensity evidence and what the state wanted and what the jury may well have done in this case is to say, look, this is a bad guy. He did it before, he's doing it again. It's a very, very compelling conclusion. So it's not that, I don't mean to say that the jury didn't follow its instructions and didn't ask the questions presented by the district court. What I mean to say is that this evidence is, it matters. That's why the prosecutor wanted it, because it mattered to the jury. There was no limiting instruction to it. So the jury heard about this.
Didn't Mr. Reyes introduce the whole notion of something in the past by saying, this is what I do, what I've done, what I usually do, or always do, or however you want to phrase it, when we fight past?
It's not however I want to phrase it. He said, I usually close the door. So I think when asked, why did he do that? Him saying, I usually close the door. In no way is he opening up the door to being questioned about every fight he's had in the past with his wife. I don't think he's introducing anything or opening the door in any way to the admission of every fight he's ever had and instances where he did or did not open the door.
But wouldn't you agree it's an acknowledgement that they have had fights in the past?
I agree it's acknowledgement that they have had fights in the past, correct. And that's not the problem, the jury knowing that they've argued in the past.
But so isn't he said, that your 404B point?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that your 404B point?
No, it's not merely the argument. It's the violent nature of the argument. It's not the fact that Mr. Reyes and his wife had argued. It's that had apparently resulted in the police being called, a police report being made, and criminal charges being brought. The second error I'd like to talk about is that the district court allowed the state to admit the wife's testimony from the preliminary hearing after finding she was unavailable within the meaning of the Idaho Rules of Evidence. And I think this is also a very clear error just under the language of the rule. So on the second day of trial, the state said it could not serve the wife with the subpoena for the correct trial dates, and so it sought to have her declared unavailable. The district court agreed with the state that she was unavailable because she had not been served and was apparently avoiding the service of process. So the district court allowed the state to read the wife's testimony in from the preliminary hearing. This is despite the fact that the defense counsel told the court that Ms. Reyes was under a subpoena to appear the next day. She did in fact appear the next day. The state had not concluded its case in chief on that next day. The state could have called her that next day. There's no guarantee that a party be able to call a witness on whatever day the party sees fit. The rule specifically states that a declarant is considered to be unavailable if the declarant, quote, is absent from the trial or hearing and the statement's proponent has not been able, by process or other reasonable means, to procure the declarant's attendance. So here, Ms. Reyes was not unavailable. She was going to appear and did in fact appear the very next day. The state could have presented her testimony at that time.
Ms. Reynolds. Mr. Reynolds. Sorry, go ahead.
Ms. Reynolds, what would prohibit the defense from releasing her from the subpoena?
Your Honor, there's nothing that would prohibit the defense from releasing her from the subpoena. Also, there's no guarantee that she would show up, even though she was compelled to do so under that subpoena. And had it been the case that the next day, Ms. Reyes did not, in fact, appear as she was subpoenaed to do and as defense counsel said she would, then the state could then have moved to declare her unavailable at that time. The problem here is that the court made that determination, even though she was under subpoena and did in fact appear the next day. So it would be a different analysis if she did not appear, either if defense counsel released her from the subpoena or she did not appear that next day as the attorney said she was going to do.
Ms. Reynolds, did you say the state had not closed its case in chief that the day she showed up?
That's correct. I believe that the state completed its case in chief that next day, but she, not the day that the court made the availability determination.
But she, in fact, does not testify. And couldn't this, if at that point, couldn't the state have also have declared her unavailable?
Well, Your Honor, she did not testify for the state because by the time she appeared the next day, the state had already read her preliminary hearing transcript to the jury. So the unavailability determination was made, the preliminary hearing transcript was read, then the next day when she did in fact appear, she did not testify for the state at that time. Her testimony for the preliminary hearing had already been read. What happened then is that the defense attorney in fact called Ms. Reyes as its first witness, and she invoked the Fifth Amendment at that point, whether rightly or wrongly is not a question in this appeal, but invoked the Fifth and did not testify for the defense.
But if there hadn't been a preliminary, if the preliminary hearing testimony hadn't been read before, it could have been read then.
If the preliminary hearing testimony had not been read before and she had showed up and refused to testify and took the Fifth at that point, then yes, at that point, I think she would be unavailable within the meaning of the rule. But this is putting the cart before the horse. So I think that what this goes to is whether the error was harmless. What it goes to is whether this would have been the result anyway. And I think the problem with that is it's counterfactual. It's hard to say. I mean, the whole trial could well have been different, or her role in the trial could well have been different had she not been declared unavailable. So to say, look, that even if there was error in declaring her unavailable, she later pled the Fifth, and so she would have been declared unavailable at that point, ignores that it all could have come out differently. So that's one way of looking at it. But what might have happened is that the state would call her the next day. She would testify, as I think she intended to do, that she couldn't recollect what had happened. She might not have invoked the Fifth. She might not have had an attorney appointed. She might not have gone down that road, and there wouldn't have been any unavailability determination. So I think we can argue what might have happened back and forth, but that's what makes it sort of not harmless, is that we don't know what would have happened. It would have affected her role in the proceedings. The first question is, did the district court err in concluding she was unavailable within the meaning of the rule? I think that's clear just looking at the language of the rule. The second is getting into the harmlessness. And that's really, I think, the heart of this case is the harmless error analysis, because we have the state's two conceded errors. We have these two additional errors I've touched briefly on. There's additional errors referenced in the brief. So the ultimate question for this court are the multiple errors in this case. There are multiple errors. The state acknowledges two errors. There are at least two errors. I think there's many more. Were these errors harmless? And so that, I think, is the question that the court's going to be grappling with. The state, of course, bears the burden of proving that these errors are harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. We know that's the standard. Now, since the briefing, the Idaho Supreme Court has released Garcia, which the state supplemented with. Under Garcia, the proper showing for harmless error is not overwhelming evidence of guilt. The question is not, does this court believe Mr. Reyes is guilty? That's not the question. Harmless error is, quote, error unimportant in relation to everything else the jury considered on the issue in question as revealed in the record. Determining whether error is harmless requires weighing the probative force of the record as a whole while excluding the erroneous evidence. So here it's looking at all the erroneously admitted evidence, taking that out and weighing the rest of the case. The question is whether the erroneously admitted evidence contributed to the verdict rendered. So that's the standard. We know that from Garcia. It's now clearer than it was at the briefing stage what the test is. Looking at that test, the errors, the multiple errors that occurred, paint Mr. Reyes as a bad person, a repeat offender, someone who people are afraid of, someone who should be locked up. That's what the prosecutor wanted the jury to believe. That's what all of this evidence went to. I think.
But Ms. Reynolds, don't we sort of weigh that against all of the other evidence in the record? So all of the physical evidence that contradicted Mr. Reyes's version of events and all of the other testimony. And in light of that, how can you say that any error actually contributed to the verdict rendered?
I think it's a challenging analysis. You're right, Chief Judge Husky, that's the analysis, to take out all of the erroneously admitted evidence, put it aside, and look at the rest of the evidence and say, was that excluded evidence unimportant in relation to everything else? And it's, you know, it's this artificial process you can't forget everything else you've seen. It's sort of like when there's a court trial and there's evidence that's excluded, how does the court not think of it? But that's the task confronted to this court. So you have to look at what should not have been considered and says, is that unimportant? So here we have the only direct testimony from the victim. That certainly mattered to the state. The state tried hard to get that in. We know there was a self-defense instruction. We have an error that I didn't touch on, the prosecutor implying in closing that the wife didn't testify because she was scared of Mr. Reyes, okay, even though that's not why she didn't testify.
What about all the physical evidence? I mean, there's all the physical evidence, there's the testimony from the medical professionals. His claim that she fell out on the patio is belied by the lack of any physical evidence of injury occurring out on the patio.
Yes, Your Honor, we do have the physical evidence, but the challenge is we have a domestic disturbance, we have a fight between a man and a woman, both under the influence of alcohol, with other people there also under the influence of alcohol. What actually happened is up in the air. I don't think that the rest of the evidence, you can say looking at that necessarily
how is the evidence in the air? I'm unclear about how what happened is up in the air. I mean, the testimony is all pretty consistent with the exception of Mr. Reyes.
Well, and I believe the neighbor as well supported Mr. Reyes's.
But the physical evidence doesn't support the neighbor's version of the events.
Well, if you're talking about the physical evidence of her injuries, the testimony from the doctor and the dentist was based on the wife's description of what occurred to her on the night in question. And so had she testified, had we not had the preliminary hearing transcript, and had she said, look, I don't recall what happened, we were both drinking, I don't recall exactly what happened, I think it might have made a difference. Certainly, you know, anytime you have two people fighting, whether it's a husband and wife or two brothers or guys in the street, whatever, I think there's different versions of what happened. My concern is that if this court finds these errors to be harmless, what it does is invites the prosecution to get any evidence before the jury, even if the court rules it can't be admitted, just get it out in questioning, get it out in argument somehow, and get that guilty verdict. And what we want is exactly the opposite to happen. I mean, if this court is convinced that Mr. Reyes is guilty, doesn't mean that the errors were harmless. It means let the state retry him, present the evidence that should be presented, exclude the evidence that should be excluded, and see what the jury comes up with. That's how the system works. No longer can this court merely say, well, there's overwhelming evidence of guilt. That means the errors weren't harmless. Done. I think it's a little bit more nuanced than that. It's maybe not so far as, you know, the Sullivan standard. We know now that that doesn't apply in the case of evidentiary errors. But still, it's not just the question of, oh, come on, his story is unbelievable. Let's let the jury decide if that story is believable. Let's let the state present the evidence that should be admitted under the rules and see if the jury, you know, concludes on remand that he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt with the evidence that it should properly consider, then that's that. But to look at multiple errors like we have in this case and say that they're unimportant, I mean, if they're unimportant, why would the state work so hard to get that evidence in the district court, I wonder? I mean, it's not simply of saying, oh, come on, his story is far-fetched. Look at the injuries she suffered. I think it just requires a little bit more of a nuanced analysis than that. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Ms. Reynolds?
Yes.
When you say it requires more of a nuanced analysis than that, what do you mean?
Well, I think that before we had the state in its briefing arguing that if there's overwhelming evidence of guilt, that means the errors were not harmless. And I don't think that that's the standard anymore. Well, we know that's not the standard under Garcia. It's not simply, does the court believe that Mr. Reyes is guilty of these crimes? Was the evidence overwhelming? The question is whether all of the erroneously admitted evidence was unimportant in relation to everything else. And I think the analysis is more difficult than simply was the evidence overwhelming. Does that make sense? That distinction?
I understand that the rejection of the overwhelming evidence, but you said it's more nuanced than looking at the evidence that was presented. So I'm wondering what nuance you think we're supposed to look at.
I think it's challenging in the case of cumulative error, because I think to say, what was all the evidence before the jury when there's multiple errors that resulted in evidence that should have been excluded, it's hard as the, reviewing court, or as anyone looking at the facts from a, dry record after the fact, to say, would the results have been the same? Would the results have been different? I think that's hard to do. And so the nuance I'm referring to is that I think it's a challenge in a case of cumulative error like this one, that we are certainly in that territory. To say, I know Chief Justice Husky is struggling, well, the story doesn't make sense, you have the physical evidence. Well, that's really for the jury to consider. Ideally, there would be no errors in this trial. All the evidence that should have been admitted, all the evidence should have been excluded, and then let the jury make that determination. But when we have these errors,
But Ms. Reynolds, isn't that exactly what the reviewing court has to do? Is we have to look at the evidence that's presented. So it isn't really that this should get remanded for a determination by a jury. If this court can look at the evidence presented and say, even in light of the errors, there was proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, the question is, what was the weight of the evidence that was erroneously admitted? So did that evidence matter? Did the wife's preliminary hearing transcript matter? Did the fact that the jury heard the prosecutor argue that Mr. Reyes was feared matter? Did it matter that the jury heard about the fight that Mr. Reyes had 2 years earlier with the same victim, similar charges? Did that matter in terms of everything that was presented? And so if we're left saying, well, gosh, it might not matter, that seems like pretty important stuff. I mean, yeah, there was a lot of physical evidence that was uncontradicted, but those things matter. I mean, the fact that it was the only testimony from the victim, the fact that, what the prosecutor wanted the jury to believe propensity-wise, that he did it once, he did it again. He's a bad person. He beat his wife in 2015. He got away with it. Let's not let him get away with it here. I mean, that stuff mattered. So I think...
Is that what the prosecutor argued? He beat his wife in 2015. Let us not let him get away with that again.
I think that that's the prosecutor's questioning with respect to the 2015 police report went exactly to that, to the propensity evidence that he did these actions before and he did them again. Yes.
Well, the prosecutor, you made it sound like the prosecutor presented an argument.
Well, I think he was an argument was questioning. He actually went beyond the district court's ruling, questioned Mr. Reyes about the criminal charges when the court had instructed him not to. When Mr. Reyes answered no, 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 the prosecutor continued to ask questions flat out of the police report, trying to get this evidence that had already been ruled to be excluded before the jury. So I actually think his questions did cross the line there into making an argument. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Reynolds. Mr. Wake?
May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to start with harmless error as well, both because, as counsel noted, the state has conceded some error and because there's some dispute in the briefing about the harmless error analysis. I think the counsel is correct that dispute in the briefing has been resolved by State v. Garcia. So the court in Garcia held, when the effect of the error is minimal compared to the probative force of the record establishing guilt beyond a reasonable doubt without the error, it can be said that the error did not contribute to the verdict rendered and is therefore harmless. So we're supposed to weigh the probative effect of the erroneously admitted evidence against the probative effect of the remaining evidence presented to the jury to determine whether the evidence established guilt beyond a reasonable doubt and whether the error is harmless. I want to focus on the remaining evidence for a moment, setting aside the erroneously admitted evidence that the state concedes was erroneously admitted. So that's the state's made two concessions. One concession that the district court erroneously admitted testimony that Mr. Reyes violated his probation that night, and two, that the district court erroneously admitted evidence regarding criminal charges in a prior case. So setting those aside entirely, I want to look at the remaining evidence. What we've got is, I know that overwhelming evidence is a troubling phrase perhaps, but really overwhelming evidence. Setting aside the errors, the evidence here is overwhelming. We have two witnesses who were there on the night in question, Mr. and Mrs. Neri. They both testified in two remarkably similar accounts of what happened that night. They testified that they were out with the Reyeses drinking at a bar. They came home that evening. They were on the back patio drinking. The Reyeses began to argue. Mr. Reyes grabbed Mrs. Reyes by the wrist and attempted to force her to go to the bedroom. The Reyeses went to the bedroom roughly a half an hour later while the Neris were trying to sleep on the couch. They heard banging and yelling from the bedroom. When they went to investigate, they found Mr. Reyes with his right hand around Mrs. Reyes' neck, pinning her against a wall. They identified the same wall as the wall against which she was pinned. They both said it was her right hand. Mrs. Neri at this point calls police, but without actually talking to the dispatcher, she just leaves the line connected. That call is in the record and was introduced to the jury. The call reflects, and the dispatcher testified that they can hear a woman in distress in the background. The Neris try to break up this fight between the Reyeses, eventually getting Mrs. Reyes out of the room and leading her into the living room. Mr. Reyes comes from behind, grabs Mrs. Reyes by her hair, pulls her to the ground. As she's getting up from the ground, Mr. Reyes kicks Mrs. Reyes in the face, where she is left semi-conscious and bleeding profusely. Mr. Neri then tries to get Mr. Reyes out of the house. They encounter officers. Mr. Reyes's response to the officers is to immediately go back in the house and close the door while disobeying the officer's instructions. And when the officers come in the house, he tells them nothing happened, while Mrs. Reyes is laying on the floor, semi-conscious, bleeding profusely.
Mr. Wake.
Yes, Your Honor.
Were the Neris cross-examined or examined on their ability to recall events in light of their intoxication?
Your Honor, they were. I'm trying to recall the record. I apologize. They were both cross-examined regarding having consumed alcohol that night. Both of them testified, as I recall, and I would have to look for a record site. I apologize. Both of them testified, as I recall, that they had consumed alcohol, but they were not significantly inebriated. That's my recollection. Mr. Reyes, to be fair, Mr. Reyes testified that they had both consumed a large quantity of alcohol and were highly inebriated. In fact, he testified that everybody but him had consumed a high quantity of alcohol and were inebriated.
Were the law enforcement officers, I assume there were law enforcement officers who testified as well, and were they asked about how intoxicated the individuals at the scene were?
They were, Your Honor. They testified that they didn't notice any obvious signs of intoxication on the part of the Neris. Mrs. Reyes, again, was very out of it. So there was no, as I recall, there was no testimony about whether she appeared intoxicated. She just appeared as though she'd been kicked in the face. And I apologize, I don't recall whether they testified whether Mr. Reyes appeared intoxicated. But I do recall that with respect to the Neris, they testified that they did not appear to be obvious signs of intoxication, though there were some communication issues because they weren't speaking, English wasn't their first language.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. So that's all just the Neris testimony, the police call, police video. Then we have an ER doctor who saw Mrs. Reyes that night, who testified that Mrs. Reyes told him that her injuries were a result of having been beaten and kicked, beaten and strangled by her husband. Then we have a dentist, Mrs. Reyes's dentist, who testified that Mrs. Reyes told her that the fractured teeth and soft tissue damage to her face was a result of Mr. Reyes having kicked her in the face. All of that evidence is, there's really, it's not contested in any way. The physical evidence then is also consistent with what the Nerys testified to. Mrs. Reyes had bruising around her neck, indicative of attempted strangulation. She had bruising on her wrist, again, verifying or substantiating the testimony that Mr. Reyes had grabbed her by the wrist and attempted to force her to the bedroom. There was bruising around her chest and arms, substantiating the testimony that there was a physical fight in the bedroom. There is no blood on the patio, so Mr. Reyes' story just made very little sense and was not substantiated by any credible evidence. Mr. Reyes claimed that he separated himself from Mrs. Reyes, a fight with Mrs. Reyes, as was his practice and habit. Sometime later, while he's in bed asleep with the door locked, because that's, again, his practice and habit, Mrs. Reyes, alone on the patio, falls on her face, immediately gets up, having fallen, holding her nose, heads into the house, and immediately goes to the bedroom, knocks in the locked door, and begins attacking Mr. Reyes. According to Mr. Reyes, the Nerys then immediately come in and join in this attack on him. He does nothing more, he claims, than stand up, put on his shorts, push through the attackers, and immediately head out to the living room in the front yard. So that's Mr. Reyes' story. The only evidence to substantiate that is Mr. Reyes' testimony and the testimony of a neighbor who he claimed that he had not previously met, but who he met in jail on these charges. According to that neighbor, he witnessed Mrs. Reyes fall on the patio. There's no blood on the patio. There's no blood leading in from the patio towards the bedroom. There's no explanation why Mrs. Reyes, having just fallen and seriously injured herself, fracturing teeth, breaking her nose, would decide that was the point at which she would rush in and break down the bedroom and attack her sleeping husband, rather than perhaps, I don't know, call an ambulance or do something a little more reasonable under the circumstances. There's no evidence or testimony as to why the Nerys would join in this attack. No suggestion that they were somehow angry with Mr. Reyes or they would have any interest in attacking him. No explanation as to how Mrs. Reyes ends up semi-conscious and bleeding profusely on the living room floor if the injury occurred on the patio and she had the fortitude and vitality to get up and go attack Mr. Reyes. How did she end up on the floor in the living room? There's no explanation as to how Mr. Reyes ends up outside. And the police are there to greet him, how so quickly, if all he did was get up, put on his shorts, and leave the house when he was attacked. There's no explanation why Mrs. Nery would call police when apparently she was one of the attackers. Mr. Reyes' story just makes no sense at all. So I want to get that case out because it's clear from Garcia that one side of this weighing is the evidence in support of guilt, subtracting the errors, as it were, and the evidence is extremely strong. The errors here would have to be incredibly probative. The evidence would have to be extremely prejudicial to constitute harmful error, given the evidence that was properly admitted. So let me move to the errors the state has conceded. First, the state conceded that the district court improperly permitted the introduction of testimony that Mr. Reyes was violating his probation that night by being in a bar drinking. And I want to correct opposing counsel here. The concession is not that the district court erred by admitting evidence that Mr. Reyes was on probation. That's not an error below. The error was admitting evidence that he violated that probation by drinking. So in the testimony, if you look to the testimony, what happened is Mr. Reyes testified without objection that he was convicted of witness intimidation. Then he testified without objection that he was on probation for that charge on the night in question, felony probation. So that he was on felony probation on the night in question is in the case without objection at this point. When the prosecutor goes on to ask, did you violate your probation by consuming alcohol that night, that's where we get a relevance objection. And the state has conceded that whether he violated his probation that night by drinking alcohol is not relevant. And so the district court properly admitted that evidence. But the evidence is that he violated his probation that night, where what the jury already knows is that he was on probation that night. So the prejudicial effect that we have to weigh here is just that he was drinking alcohol when he shouldn't have been, though they already knew he was on probation. And the state contends that's not prejudicial, incredibly minimally prejudicial, if it's prejudicial at all. Let me move on to the impeachment issue. There are really two issues here, I think. Again, one that the state hasn't conceded and one that the state has. First, was the state permitted to impeach Mr. Reyes as to his alleged practice or habit of separating himself from his wife when they argued so as to avoid further conflict by either going in the bedroom and locking the door or getting in the car and leaving? And the second issue is, did the district court err by permitting the state to introduce testimony that in a particular previous case, there were various criminal allegations or charges at issue? So let me start with the first issue. The state was absolutely permitted to impeach Mr. Reyes on his testimony that he, quote, usually separates himself from his wife when they argue by going in his bedroom and locking his door. It was absolutely clear to everyone below that this was testimony being offered to substantiate Mr. Reyes's testimony that that's what he did that night. That night he went to his bedroom. So he testified that he went to his bedroom and locked his door when he and his wife started arguing. The defense counsel asked him why he did that, and he said, because that's what he usually does. That is, he was testifying that it's his practice to go to the bedroom and lock the door when he and his wife fight to avoid further conflict. He's essentially offering character evidence here. He's testifying that his character or his practice is to avoid conflict of this sort by separating himself from his wife. Having introduced that testimony, he was subject to impeachment regarding whether that's in fact his standard practice. And there's no question, again, that this is the sort of testimony he was offering. So before the defense began presenting evidence, they forecasted their intent to offer evidence that it was his, quote, habit and his, quote, custom when he got in an argument to do one of two things. He'd lock himself in the bedroom or he'd go out to his car and leave. That's defense counsel characterizing the testimony. He then offered his testimony. After the testimony, defense counsel again characterized his testimony as having been that he, quote, he locks the doors when he argues. Again, he's testifying, or he's characterizing the testimony as it being Mr. Reyes's practice to lock the doors when he argues with his wife. The district court then characterized the testimony as having been that, quote, his procedure is to go into his bedroom and lock the door. Everyone understood that Mr. Reyes was arguing that he's got this practice, this procedure, this standard routine of avoiding conflict with his wife by separating himself from the situation and locking the door. Having introduced that testimony, he's subject to impeachment with respect to the testimony. I believe it was Judge Lorello who asked whether Mr. Reyes argued below that the use of the qualifier usually somehow immunized himself from impeachment. As far as I know, unless I missed a portion of the transcript, he never made that argument. His argument below was sort of it was very conclusory, just, he's not subject to impeachment on this or something to that effect. He never suggested that the use of the word usually somehow immunized himself from impeachment evidence. But even if he had made that argument, it fails. I mean, you can't sort of make this, present as testimony of that sort in order to show that you had a practice or a character to avoid conflict, couch it in usually or typically language and thereby prevent any sort of impeachment evidence from coming in. There's no case law to support that proposition. It was clearly relevant. The district court did the balancing analysis, the 403 balancing analysis, and determined that the probative value was not substantially outweighed by any prejudicial effect. The court acknowledged that there was some prejudicial effect, but that the probative value was not substantially outweighed and so properly admitted the evidence. On the second issue, in this sort of ballpark, the issue on which the court has conceded, or the state has conceded error, this questioning, if you look at the 10 pages of transcript that's concerned with this questioning, the questioning begins with the state referring to the content of a police report and referring to criminal charges associated with that police report or mentioned in that police report, and asking Mr. Reyes if he recalls the incident. What the state has conceded, so Mr. Reyes' counsel objects at that point. The state has conceded that the error was a reference to criminal charges associated with that occasion. What counsel should have done and what counsel does in a fair portion of the remaining transcript is just ask questions about the events in question without reference to some criminal charges. So the error that's been conceded is just the reference to the criminal charges. If you look to the rest of the transcript, there are really fairly few additional objections. There's one objection as to a foundation, which is not at issue on appeal. And there's an objection as to, counsel objects that a question was asked and answered. That's not at issue on appeal. For the next 10 pages, you don't get any additional objections. Until the final page of the transcript where counsel objects twice, the court sustains those objections and instructs the jury not to consider the question or their answers. So the only objection that's at issue is this objection to a reference to criminal charges associated with this prior event. And the state has acknowledged error with respect to the admission of that evidence. But the error is harmless. So.
Counsel, was there testimony or evidence before the jury that those charges were dismissed?
Yes, Your Honor, that was where I was going. So okay. Harmless, though there's error, it's harmless. One of the reasons it's harmless is that the defense counsel, outside the presence of the jury, asked the court that he be permitted to mitigate any harm associated with the introduction of evidence regarding those charges by asking whether the charges had been pursued by the prosecutor. The district court permitted defense counsel to do that, and the jury heard that the prosecutor had not pursued the charges, except for, so there were four charges, I believe: attempted strangulation, battery, witness intimidation, and malicious injury to property. The battery charge, the attempted strangulation charge, and the malicious injury to property charge, the jury heard that all of those were not pursued by the prosecutor. The jury heard that the witness intimidation charge ended in a conviction, but that was, again, without any objection from counsel. So for that reason, any error was harmless. But in addition, the error was additionally harmless because to the extent that there was harm associated with the jury hearing about those charges, it was prejudice associated with the jury getting the impression that Mr. Reyes had a previous history of domestic violence. But the jury already had heard, again, without any objection, evidence suggesting that Mr. Reyes had a history of domestic violence. So the jury had already heard, for example, that an officer investigating on the night in question, that Mrs. Neri told him that damage to a door had been caused, quote, by Marina's head crashing into it from a prior incident. The jury had already heard that. The jury had already heard in testimony from the same officer that Mrs. Neri told him that she had witnessed, quote, several domestic violence incidences involving Mr. Reyes. The prosecutor's victim witness coordinator testified that she was familiar with Mrs. Reyes because she had worked with Mrs. Reyes, quote, on a previous case. So the jury already had evidence that there was a history of domestic violence here. And so any error associated with the mention of charges that the prosecutor didn't end up pursuing really was not harm, particularly prejudicial. And again, I won't repeat the case, but even that minimal prejudice has to be weighed against the evidence that's not objected to, which is overwhelming. Unless the court has further questions on that issue, I'll turn to the unavailability issue. So unavailability, the district court determined that Mrs. Reyes was unavailable as a witness under IRE 804A4A, and so preliminary hearing testimony could come in at trial as a hearsay exception. So that rule, 804A4A, provides that a declarant is unavailable as a witness when the declarant is, quote, absent from the trial, unquote, and, quote, the statement's proponent has not been able to procure the declarant's attendance. The district court found, as a matter of fact, that Mrs. Reyes was not present at the trial, and that the state, the statement's proponent, the party trying to introduce the out-of-court statement, was unable to secure her attendance at trial through good faith efforts. The court found, as a matter of fact, that the state had made good faith efforts to secure her attendance over a significant period of time, and the court found, as a matter of fact, that Mrs. Reyes had been steadfastly avoiding the service of process, had been making herself unavailable to the state for the service of process. As I understand it, Mr. Reyes isn't challenging either of those factual findings on appeal. And so under the clear terms of the rule, Mrs. Reyes was not available at trial, and the evidence and the testimony could come in as a hearsay exception. The argument Mr. Reyes is making on appeal is that rather than looking to whether the proponent of the statement has been able to procure the attendance of the witness at trial, the court should look to, it should be a sort of determining factor that defense counsel represents that the witness will appear at a later date as a defense witness. But the rule doesn't provide that the defense counsel gets to sort of veto an unavailability finding by representing that the witness will appear at a later date, probably, hopefully, we think. The court made a finding that Mrs. Reyes was not available, and that finding really hasn't been challenged. But let me address harmlessness here too. The error is, any error, if there is error, is clearly harmless. What the error amounts to here is nothing more than that the preliminary hearing testimony was presented a day earlier than it otherwise would have been. Mrs. Reyes appeared as a witness for the defense and asserted her Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. And under Rule 804A1, she was therefore unavailable as a witness. At that point, there's no question that the state could have admitted her preliminary hearing testimony under a hearsay exception. So the preliminary hearing testimony was just admitted a day earlier than it otherwise would have been. And there's no explanation how there's any harm or prejudice associated with that sort of error, even if there was error here. One additional comment, even if Mrs. Reyes had appeared the next day and testified without asserting her Fifth Amendment privilege, there's no evidence that she would have done that. The potential for perjury was the existence and content of the preliminary hearing testimony, not that it was in fact offered in this particular trial. But even if she had appeared the next day and testified, the preliminary hearing testimony could have come in as impeachment. So it would still have come in. And setting all of that aside, the preliminary hearing testimony was also largely duplicative of evidence that was already presented at trial. So the preliminary hearing testimony is not particularly in depth, doesn't go into a lot of detail. Mrs. Reyes roughly testifies that her injuries were caused by Mr. Reyes strangling her, beating her, and kicking her in the face. There was already testimony before the jury from Mrs. Reyes' ER physician and from her dentist that she had said that her injuries were caused by Mr. Reyes strangling her, beating her, and kicking her in the face. So this is all testimony. Granted, the testimony already in was via these physicians, these doctors, but it was testimony that was already before the jury. Let me move quickly to the, I'll skip over Mrs. Neri's testimony about why she asked police to lie for her unless the court has questions about that, and just briefly address the prosecutorial misconduct claim. So the claim here is that the prosecutor misleadingly suggested that Mrs. Reyes didn't testify at trial because she was scared or fearful of Mr. Reyes. There's absolutely nothing in the record to support that claim. If you look to the argument, look to the portion of the transcript where the prosecutor is offering that argument, what the prosecutor does is refer to prior testimony from a expert on domestic violence that testified on behalf of the state. That expert testified that there are a variety of reasons why victims of domestic violence find it difficult to participate later at trial, including embarrassment, including low self-esteem, low self-confidence. And while it would have been nice and while the state would have liked Ms. Reyes to testify, the jury shouldn't draw inferences based on the fact that Mrs. Reyes didn't testify. And the court said, so that the sentence that's allegedly troubling is, certainly Maria is probably scared. But the prosecutor immediately follows that up by saying, it's understandable that Mrs. Reyes should not want to, quote, tell a room of strangers about the abuse she suffered at the hands of someone she loved. The argument wasn't in any way connected to fear of Mr. Reyes. It was an argument about the fear of having to tell her story again in front of a group of strangers when that's a traumatic and difficult thing for domestic violence victims to do. There's absolutely nothing in the record to suggest that the prosecutor was suggesting that Mrs. Reyes was declining to testify because she was afraid of Mr. Reyes. Unless the court has further questions, I'd ask that the court affirm Mr. Reyes' judgment of conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Wake. Ms. Reynolds?
Thank you. Judge Groton, I'd like to begin by addressing your question regarding whether the jury heard that the earlier charges in the case were dismissed. The jury did hear that the earlier charges were dismissed with the exception of the intimidating a witness. However, the prosecutor told the jury, quote, there's a reason the charge was dropped. So the reason the charges were dropped gets in the prosecutorial misconduct issue, gets into what is the underlying story that the prosecution is trying to tell the jury. The reason the charges were dropped has to do with the wife's testimony. And it's the same problem that the prosecution wanted the jury to recognize here, that the wife was not testifying because she was afraid of Mr. Reyes, afraid of telling her story as a victim of domestic abuse. The prosecution wants that to be the theme of the case. So the fact that the jury heard that the earlier charges were dismissed does not render that error harmless, of the jury hearing about those charges. Again, what the prosecution is trying to do in multiple ways is to get the evidence before the jury that this is a bad guy, he's done it before, he did it again, that he should be found guilty in this case.
Ms. Reynolds, can you point me to the place in the transcript where there's the discussion about why the charges were dismissed?
I don't have the page reference before me. I'm sorry, I don't have the entire transcript available to me. Judge Roller, I did look earlier with respect to your earlier question about defendant.
Before you move on, I just want to make sure I understand what you had just said, that the jury also heard, in addition to the charges, the earlier charges being dismissed, there was evidence presented that they were dismissed because Ms. Reyes was afraid of the defendant?
No, the prosecutor told the jury there's a reason the charge was dropped.
Okay, so there was no evidence presented that there was a reason, that the reason was because Ms. Reyes was afraid of the defendant.
I think the reason that the prosecutor is referring to, the reason the charge was dropped, is because of the wife's testimony.
But my question to you is, what did the jury hear as to the reason the charges were dropped?
I think the jury heard what the prosecutor tried to do again and again, is painting Mr. Reyes as this bad person, this repeat offender.
So the jury heard an inference?
Well, I think the prosecutor wanted the jury to infer, that's correct. The prosecutor wanted the jury to infer that the reason the charges were dropped earlier against Mr. Reyes is because the wife wouldn't testify, just as she wasn't testifying here, because she was afraid of Mr. Reyes.
And can you point me to where in the transcript that inference is being made?
I think it's being made in the questioning of Mr. Reyes about the earlier criminal charges. I think it's being made in the closing argument when the prosecutor tells the jury that Ms. Reyes is scared of testifying.
But you can't tell me where in the transcript the jury is being asked to infer why the charges were dismissed specifically.
I think that's the nature of the inference. You're right, there's not, the prosecutor isn't connecting all the dots for the jury. I think it's there in the prosecutor's questioning and argument that the jury should infer that the charges were dismissed because of the wife's refusal to testify in the earlier case, or changing of her story in the earlier case, just as she did here, that she's afraid of Mr. Reyes, again, that he's a bad person, that he committed these crimes before and did it again.
So, Ms. Reynolds, just so that I understand, Mr. Wake indicated that after the prosecutor said Ms. Reyes was scared, he then said, because it's difficult to come in front of a group of strangers and talk about this intimate event, and I'm paraphrasing. And from that statement, the jury was to infer not that she was afraid of disclosing to a group of strangers, but rather she was afraid of Mr. Reyes?
Yes, I think what the prosecutor, and I believe it was the female prosecutor at that point, was talking about the expert testimony on why victims of domestic abuse sometimes refuse to testify against their accusers or change their stories. And so saying that Ms. Reyes was afraid, she didn't want to come up here and testify about the abuse she suffered at the hands of her husband, is of course assuming the very facts that the jury is being asked to find, whether she was abused at the hands of her husband. So whether she's afraid to tell her story because it's scary to get up in front of the jury, or scary to be in front of Mr. Reyes, the prosecutor is saying, you know, as a given that she suffered this abuse at the hands of her husband. She may well have been scared of testifying because the court was basically threatening her with perjury if she got on the stand and said that she didn't recall what happened on the night in question. So to say that she's afraid of testifying because it's scary to get in front of a room of people and talk about the abuse you suffer at the hands of your husband is asking the jury to find she suffered abuse at the hands of her husband. I mean, I think it's all part and parcel of what the prosecutor's story of the case is. And I think that's why the harmless error analysis is so challenging, and that pulling apart the multiple errors that occurred and saying that they were unimportant in relation to everything else is both a challenge, and I think in undertaking that challenge, it does not lead to a finding beyond a reasonable doubt that the errors were harmless in this case.
Wasn't the entirety of the state's closing argument asking the jury to find that she suffered abuse at the hands of her husband?
Yes, but saying that she didn't testify because she suffered that abuse, because she's scared of telling her true story, when in fact the true story may have been that she didn't recall what happened, because perhaps she was under the influence of alcohol because of the injury she suffered, she actually could not recall the event. That may have been why she didn't testify. She was being threatened with perjury by the court, assigned an attorney she did not ask for, you know, that resulting in her invoking the Fifth Amendment again, whether rightly or wrongly. So to say that she's...
Was the complained of portion of the argument that you're highlighting here today in the state's original closing? Or was it rebuttal?
I believe it was in rebuttal closing. So again, I think we have the errors that the state concedes. We have the additional errors that I think we've talked about at length and are well-briefed regarding the questioning about the earlier incident and the charges resulting therefrom, and the finding that the wife was unavailable under the rules. Looking at all these together, I think that they were not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and we ask this court to vacate Mr. Reyes's conviction.
Ms. Reynolds, I had interrupted you earlier to talk about I think the closing argument, and you were going to say that you found somewhere in the transcript in response to my earlier question.
I'm seeing that I'm out of time. May I answer your question?
Please.
Yes. So I was looking at the appellant's brief. Footnote 4 of the appellant's brief does reference the fact that the objection was not, there was no specific basis provided for that objection with respect to the admission of the evidence on issue 1. Cited in that footnote is Almaraz, for the court can find an issue preserved if the basis for that objection is clear from the record. And I believe that's the case here, that it was improper impeachment evidence.
But not the argument that it didn't open the door because he only said usually and not always. That argument was not.
There's just you are correct in the earlier questioning that you asked me that the objection was just objection, Your Honor. There's not a specific basis for it in the record. And again, that's just addressed in footnote 4.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Reynolds. The court appreciates the briefing and argument in this case. Court will take this case under advisement, issue an opinion in due course, and the court will be in recess until 1:30 this afternoon.